Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. We are going to be talking about a subject matter today that I know it's going to be intriguing to you, but more than that, the man that has put and compiled this information together is a researcher. And this takes a special kind of personality. It takes someone that's willing to go through, I don't know how many millions of pieces of information, and then be able to sort through it. And it said we always look at things through our own paradigms. And I'm going to ask my guest, Nick Redfern, who has put together a book for Nobody's Eyes Only, a question. And Nick, I want to welcome you to the show, first of all. But I want you to tell me how it is you can go through so much material and be able to compress it down into a compartmentalization of information?
That's a good question. A lot of it, basically, Donna, just comes from sort of going to archives and checking out information that's been released through the Freedom of Information Act and picking out the sort of the most important points and then, you know, sort of turning that into a chapter. And it's sort of always a bit of a challenge, you know, if you're writing a book on one subject, it's much easier. But when each chapter's a totally different subject, it does become a little bit more difficult to condense everything down, you know, into like a 10-page chapter. But that's what you have to do. So,
well, this book, and you've been on my show before, Nick, and you often have covered material on UFOs. And for those of you who are listening today, Nick Redfern, he's written a number of books, and he speaks all over, and he is a journalist. And in a way, he's sort of old school. And when I say old school, investigative reporting is a very, very difficult arena to be in. And so many of us, as we know, we can watch stuff. You see things that are put out through news media, and so frequently a lot of the information isn't correct. And when you are living in a world where communication often is done in seconds, we make assumptions. Nick, I'm going to ask you another question. With all of the research that you've done, with everything that you've had an involvement with, I mean, there's a lot of mysteries you've gone into. You publish your articles for many different, many groups of people and magazines. And you've been on television, all of this stuff. How has this changed your attitude about life? When you first started out in this, I'm sure you said, oh, a lot of this stuff couldn't possibly be true. But then as you get into it, how has it affected your feelings about what's going on in today's world and life as it is?
But I'd probably say more than anything else, Donnie, it makes you sort of realize that, you know, the world around us, we don't really see the full picture of what's going on. You know, we just see sort of 10 or 20% of it. So I suppose that's the main thing, is that sort of history and today and the past and the future, I guess, I mean, if it's 10% or 20% we get to see of it, the important thing is, what does the other 80% relate to? You know, that's kind of the thing it brings home to you, is that how little we actually know when it comes to a lot of the mysteries of our world.
That's true, and that's one of the components that you address. Who are the people in certain positions? What is it that goes on? What is it that's released? What is it that's hidden? And you address not just American history, but you go into Australian history, you go into British history, you touch a bit on the Russians, you touch a bit on so many different things. And when someone reads this, and they are going through it, would they be able to check out the references that you have? I know you've got a tremendous amount of them here. You've got all kinds of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I usually do with my books is to use, what I always do with my books, I should say, if they're file-based books, is I only use files which have surfaced officially through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. And many, many countries around the world have Freedom of Information Acts, like America, Britain, Canada, all the Scandinavian countries, Australia, most of Europe, and a number of South American countries as well. So dozens of countries have Freedom of Information Acts available. And you can apply for files to be declassified officially. But there are various clauses in the documents, excuse me, in the Freedom of Information Acts that allow for sort of continuing withholding of documents. So the Freedom of Information Act doesn't open all doors. It's sort of a useful tool. But very often documents can be withheld in part or in total, and in many cases for decades, depending on, you know, the extent to which it might have an effect on security if the files were released. So in those cases, you know, we don't get to see the files, but in other cases, we either get them in part or in full.
Mm-hmm. Now, there, and I'm going to pull some extracts out of your book here. One of the items that is to this day very much a part of conversation is Princess Diana's death. And people just absolutely, almost immediately said something really went wrong here. Something just isn't clicking. Now, this occurred on August 31st, 1997, and for all of what was stated as to what happened at the accident, there was a tremendous amount of information that you have, or there is, not there was, there is a tremendous amount of information in your book, For Nobody's Eyes Only, about Lady Diana, her life, and people that actually had listened in on conversations that she had had, and information that was actually made public. You've got it here in the book, where there was some kind of a bug in her phone system that she didn't know about.
Yeah, that goes back actually to the 1980s. When an organization in the UK, or several intelligence agencies in the UK, were watching Princess Diana, and this is at the time when her marriage to Prince Charles wasn't going well, and she had other boyfriends on the side, and she was sort of seen as a bit of a national security issue. You know, there were people in the royal family that didn't like her, and people in government that didn't like her, and we know today that she was watched, her phones were bugged, because some of the conversations were actually released to the press, and the reason was to try and turn the public and the media against her, but it had the actual opposite effect of where people came to support her. But I talk about one particular angle in the book, which became known as Squidgygate, and Squidgy was like a play on Watergate, but Squidgy was the nickname that one of her friends called her, Squidgy. And it involved a number of tape recordings of a conversation between Diana and a man named James Gilby. It was sort of like a flirty conversation, and it got it was picked up by a man named Cyril Renan, who was a ham radio operator. And at first, it seemed like it had been picked up just by chance. But when people whose job it was to sort of analyze sort of the early cell phones that existed back in the late 80s, actually found that it was a rebroadcasted conversation that had been bugged rather than just he'd picked up innocently on the airwaves. And all the evidence pointed to a place called GCHQ, which is like a British government listening station. And they picked it up and rebroadcasted it. Basically, as I said, in the hope it would get picked up by the media, which it did. And it would turn everybody against Diana, but it actually, as I said, had the opposite effect. And but those files, the official files, haven't been released yet. But we have had people come forward, and you know, there's a lot of evidence that points towards GCHQ as being the people who sort of were monitoring her phone and everybody else's phone that she was talking to.
Mm-hmm. So that was a fascinating aspect of your book. And then you dipped back into an aspect of history with an infamous character, Aleister Crowley. Now, Aleister Crowley, in the minds of so many people that are involved in the metaphysical area, just deem him as the hideous of the hideous. And he was an oddball. However, he was actually a member of British intelligence. Now, this is something that is pretty hard. They don't want to talk about this. Whoever does. And I know for a fact from different people that I've interviewed that have been in various positions of responsibility that even our own government has done this, has supported criminals to be able to get whatever it is that they have wanted. And this is so, this is really a topic that is very unique. And you approach this. What triggered the interest in Aleister Crowley?
Well, yeah, when you think of sort of spy agencies, you know, you think of James Bond-type characters, but Aleister Crowley was probably the most famous researcher and writer into occult-based subjects in the 20th century. And he was involved in a lot of different sort of occult rituals and rites and practices and that sort of thing. And it surprises people that information is now coming out that he did work with British intelligence in both the First World War and the Second World War. He died in 1947, so he was at an age in both wars where he was able to do work for them. And and people might think, you know, why would British intelligence employ an occultist, somebody like Crowley? And the reason why, look, actually several reasons. One was because he traveled around the world a lot, and so he was basically someone who was in place where if say, for example, British intelligence wanted to find out information on what was going on, as they did during, for example, the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, they sent Crowley out. And so when, if he was questioned, he could just say, well, I'm here doing occult-based research. So in other words, his day job, so to speak, acted as a good cover for spying on the enemy. But also the main reason was during the Second World War that the Nazis were very sort of influenced by the world of the occult. And so Crowley was brought in to try and affect German morale by creating, for example, things like faked horoscopes. For example, the Germans, the Nazis, the higher figures within the Nazi party, a lot of them were very influenced by astrological charts. Mm-hmm. So it was Crowley's job to sort of come up with faked astrological charts that would demonstrate that the Nazis were going to lose the war. So in other words, it was like a psychological warfare thing. They weren't necessarily bringing him in to put spells on the Germans, but it was his knowledge of the world of the occult and spells and magic that they used against the Nazis in like a psychological way, because they knew the Nazis believed in all that. So in other words, he wasn't an official employee of MI5, which is the British equivalent to the FBI, but he was someone who was sort of paid under the table and like an unofficial employee when they wanted, somebody of that kind of caliber involved.
Right, and he was involved and associated. He moved around within the upper circle of what we would call the power spectrum. And Ian Fleming, Maxwell Knight, Dennis Wheatley, he was very much involved with them. And, of course, Ian Fleming, he just had the 007, which novels, which were just phenomenal. And he moved in the military intelligence areas, not unlike Tom Clancy. But Sybil Leek was also one of those that was used. And Sybil Leek had gained a tremendous amount of respect and renown for her skills. And when you mentioned about astrology, she also was very famous and being British. And she was labeled as a witch. She was the most famous witch. Isn't this amazing when you find out how propaganda, one, can create a personality, two, can create a cover for work that might not ever be imagined by the average individual as to going on under the appearances?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Sybil Leek was, she was sort of labeled as Britain's most famous witch at one point, and she worked with MI5 in the 40s as well, and again during the Second World War to sort of counter the Nazis and turn their beliefs in the occult world against them. And you know, you also mentioned like Ian Fleming, who created James Bond. He was heavily involved with British intelligence, and you mentioned Dennis Wheatley, who wrote, you know, numerous horror stories over the years, horror novels, and he was actually an employee of British intelligence, and knew Crowley as well. So a lot of these people were all interlinked. But probably the most famous sort of American connection with Crowley was a man named Jack Parsons, who I talk about in the book. And Jack Parsons was very close to Crowley, and set up like a lodge in Pasadena, California, devoted to Crowley's teachings. But Jack Parsons was also one of America's most famous rocket scientists, early rocket scientists. He actually set up what became NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab eventually. And Parsons also has a crater named after him on the surface of the moon. So, and his company created the solid rocket boosters for the space shuttle. But he was someone who followed Crowley's teachings, I mean, completely, but he had a top secret clearance with the military. And before each rocket test, he would try and invoke the Greek god Pan to try and ensure like a safe flight. And the military just turned a blind eye. They basically didn't care that, you know, what he did in his private life was his business as long as he could get rockets into the sky. So, mm-hmm. Again, this is another good example of how people involved in the world of the occult are often employed in military circles because, you know, they're brilliant people, and Parsons was. You know, the fact that he was sort of a devotee and a follower of Crowley didn't matter because he was also, you know, one of the foremost rocket scientists in the 30s and 40s.
Now, there is a segment, and this is about U.S. history, and it's distressing to me when you find that records have been destroyed. And when I came across this one section, it just really blew my mind. And it was the National Personnel Records Center, the NPRC, that was created in 1956. And it was a primary storage area for the official records of all the men and women in the U.S. who had served in military or at a civilian government level. Tell us what happened to these records. This just absolutely boggles my mind.
Well, yeah, in 1973, there was a huge fire at the NPRC, and it destroyed literally millions of pages of files of the official records on people who'd served in the military, and a lot of other papers as well. And over the years, there have been a lot of rumors that the fire wasn't accidental, that somebody had, we don't know who, but there are a lot of rumors that somebody may have started the fire as a means to destroy a lot of these documents that were, you know, coming up for declassification, and other ones that would actually reveal names of people who may have been involved in sensitive operations and things like that. And that was sort of 40 years ago, and even today people still ask questions as to whether or not the fire was deliberate or not, but it actually destroyed one entire floor of the record center, and literally tens of millions of files were just destroyed. And of course, this was long before sort of large-scale photocopying and scanning. It was all the original documents, so those files were literally lost for good.
Mm-hmm. And there was CIA Director Richard Helms. And this had to do with the destruction of what were called the MK Ultra documents. Tell us what those documents were.
Well, MK Ultra was a CIA program set up in the early 50s, and it was probably the most famous of actually a lot of projects and operations were put together, but the most famous one on what's become known as like mind control or mind manipulation. And the idea is, you know, the agencies back then, all around the world, actually Britain did it and the Russians as well, was sort of research how people's minds could be controlled and manipulated by things like hypnosis or drugs and psychedelic plants, and all sorts of different research was undertaken. And in the 1970s, a lot of the CIA's files on MKUltra were destroyed on the orders of the CIA director at the time, Richard Helms, and they were literally all burned. And what happened was that a high-ranking man in the CIA, Sidney Gottlieb, was given the job of having all this material destroyed. So he turned up one day in 1973 at the CIA's archive center and said, "I'm here on the director's orders to burn all the material on MKUltra." And the man who ran the archives didn't want to do it. And Gottlieb basically said to him, "Well, if you've got a problem, take it up with the director," which he actually did. You know, he put his protest in. But a lot of these files were destroyed because there were concerns in the CIA that somebody was leaking this material. And one of the concerns they had was that the Russians might get hold of it. So the idea was to destroy the material before any more would get leaked out and end up in the hands of the Russians or the Chinese or somebody like that. So, you know, some people have sort of viewed this as like a positive step. If they couldn't prevent this whistleblower from leaking the material, then they would destroy it before he or she had chance to. And again, a lot of this was mainly original material, so we don't really know the full extent of how far MKUltra went with all its operations. But the files do show that the ones that survived the destruction do show that research went on for years, you know, to try and understand how people's minds could be sort of totally controlled and manipulated.
Mm-hmm. There is an aspect that came out on June the 12th, 2001, by the Western Australia Newspapers Limited. And when I started reading this, my first word in my head was hideous. Hideous. And it was about the period between 1955 and 1963. Maralinga, which is a part of the Woomera Test Range, it falls under the jurisdiction of the Royal Australian Air Force and is situated in South Australia, was the prime location from where the British government carried out its early atomic tests, Operation Antler and Operation Buffalo. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a story that the British government has sort of denied time and time again, but the reality is that it keeps surfacing from different people, and a lot of credible people as well. And the story is that, obviously, with Britain being a small country, there's no way that Britain could test its atomic bombs on British soil because, you know, it would just...
It would
be affected by all the radiation. So the only places they could do it would be in, like, large desert areas. And Australia has a number of locations where atomic bomb tests went ahead because, you know, in Australia, most people sort of live around the coastlines and it's a massive country. And so, you know, some of these small atomic bombs could have been, or were exploded, I should say, and tested and didn't cause any harm to the people. But one of the concerns that the British government had was, you know, how the extent to which radiation could affect people and the blast, etc. And there have been a lot of very controversial, long-standing stories about pilots flying in, like handicapped people from secretly flying them in from British hospitals, you know, people very physically handicapped and mentally handicapped, and them being kind of used as guinea pigs where they would be, you know, placed near the blast areas, and then afterwards the troops would go out and collect the bodies or the survivors and then try and figure out, you know, how quickly the people died or how quickly cancer developed afterwards. So, in other words, it was a case of, if the stories are true, of course, of the British government sort of using handicapped people in atomic bomb experiments. Now, as I said, the British government has officially denied these stories, but as I also point out in the book, a number of people have spoken out on the record about this and about their knowledge of it and seeing plane loads of handicapped people being sent out to the site and then just shipped out or bussed out, you know, to wherever and never seen again. So it's a, you know, sort of a dark part of history. But again, official files have surfaced showing that in the 1940s, people were actually taken from prisons and hospitals and used in, you know, radiation-based experiments, they're often told, oh, you know, it won't hurt you, and they, you know, give them an offer, a monetary offer or whatever, but then they would fall sick and, you know, get cancer and die. So it's sort of a very dark aspect of history, but for people who don't, you know, think that's, or people who think that's sort of too far out, the files I talk about in the book on this are all official documents, again, that have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. You know, they're not sort of questionable documents. They're all official files.
Mm-hmm. Very official. Now let's move forward to the mid-1990s. There's a young Welshman. Oh, by the way, we're going to be taking a break in a couple of minutes. Will you stay with me, Nick, for about another 15 minutes? Wonderful.
Yeah.
In the mid-1990s, there was a young Welshman. His name is Matthew Bevan. Now, this was a brilliant young man, just brilliant. He reminds me of the character that was portrayed in the very successful movie War Game. He just has this mind that is incredibly able to work in a level of process thinking that's just amazing. And he ended up hacking into the computerized files of the U.S. military.
Mm.
And he found out about a secret space plane. But tell us what happened with this, because this wasn't a malignant character. This was someone that just loves doing what everybody will say is impossible to do. And he did it.
Well, yeah, it's not impossible to do, but, you know, I don't recommend anybody does do it because it is reckless. You know, I don't defend his actions at all. You know, I think if you're going to attempt to hack into government computers or military computers, you know, they're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, and you're going to get arrested, and which is exactly what happened to Matthew Bevan. So, you know, I don't endorse what Bevan did at all. I think it was stupid and crazy and reckless and could have affected national security. But Bevan hacked into a number of military computers and claimed that when he was looking into all this material, he found documents that related to what he said was, in essence, like an anti-gravity craft, like a spacecraft that was being mm-hmm. secretly developed. You know, something far different to like a regular rocket, you know, just uses chemical propulsion to launch it into the air. It was sort of, you know, didn't really use any fuel at all. And it could go super fast and into space and all sorts of things. So it was almost like a secret space program running alongside NASA's official space program. But the story of Matthew Bevan is actually sort of widely known in the UK because, you know, the newspapers covered it, and that's where this information came from, because there was a court case which ultimately collapsed, but all this information came out in the court case. So, you know, this, what I'm telling you now, isn't based on anything that Bevan disclosed himself, you know, secretly to people. This was all part of what the regular news media reported on, and how he, you know, he testified that he'd seen this material, et cetera, et cetera. And he very nearly, you know, ended up in jail for a long time. And it was only because of extradition information, and, you know, the case fell apart. But, you know, he was going to be brought over from here in the UK to the US. And there were sort of legal roundabouts that ultimately made the case fall apart. But had it not fallen apart, you know, there's no doubt, I think, that Bevan probably would have been tried and be put in jail for a long time.
Well, I think it's very interesting because there's another case in your book that you bring up where someone did an exposure. They were taken to court in Britain, and their case evaporated. It collapsed because those that were bringing charges against him, which in this case was the United States government, wasn't willing to tell the judge about certain things. And the judges said, well, if you're not going to talk to me, we don't have anything here. You really cannot put this person in jail.
Yeah,
your story is fascinating. It really is fascinating.
Yeah, that's actually what caused the Bevan case to collapse as well, was that the prosecution refused to provide evidence of what Bevan had actually done. And so the judge said, well, if you're not going to provide evidence, then, you know, we can't really try him. And that's what caused the case to shut down.
Nick, we're going to take a break for just a minute. We're going to come back, and we've got some more interesting things to share with you about Nick's latest book, For Nobody's Eyes Only. And I think you're going to find it interesting. Marilyn Monroe, J. Edgar Hoover, and some other very famous people we'll be talking about. Maybe even JFK. That's been coming out a lot. So we'll come back in just a bit. Donna Siebel here. Don't go away.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Siebel to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna Siebel. Our guest today, if you're just joining us, is Nick Redfern. His fascinating publication is For Nobody's Eyes Only. Nick is an investigative reporter in his own way, and all of his information you can check out if you so desire. He works with publicly posted information, and one of the many people that he talks about in this book is J. Edgar Hoover. And Nick, I have to tell you, it must have been a good 15 years ago. I heard an interview done, maybe it was, I don't know what time it was really, by a gentleman who was from Australia and had been hired by a publishing company to do a book on J. Edgar Hoover. And I'll never forget, in this interview, this man made the statement that J. Edgar Hoover's name should not be posted on the FBI building because it is a name of shame. And in his research, and I didn't have the opportunity to read the book, but he said in the research, he was astonished to find out the information that he did about the man and that he was really like a little dictator. Not a little dictator, he was a big dictator. Dossiers on people, on their lives, illegal tapping, all kinds of things that he had done that had managed to cover up. And he said it was so surprising to him when he was called by the publishing company to do this book. He said, why in the world are you wanting me to write this story about J. Edgar Hoover? Why aren't you getting an American? And I said, no, we want someone that's going to be unbiased. And he said by the time he finished his research, he was appalled at what this man had done. This is something that a movie has been made about, giving information on J. Edgar Hoover, but who I find, now I think what he did was despicable, but who I find even more interesting is Helen Gandy, his secretary. This was quite a woman. Tell us how you got this information on Hoover and how you found out so much about Helen.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is sort of public domain now, but the FBI has a very good website called The Vault, which literally contains probably millions of pages of formerly classified material, again, which is all surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. And it's a really good resource which sort of provides a long history of a lot of the investigations the FBI were involved in, like gangster investigations in the 30s and then looking for Nazi spies in the 40s and Russian spies in the 50s and all sorts of things like that. But as well as the official files that the FBI put together, it's sort of long been acknowledged that Hoover had his own files that were known as the secret files, and these were sort of separate files to the official investigations that the FBI carried out. And throughout most of his time as director of the FBI, Hoover's secretary was a woman named Helen Gandy, and she was very loyal to him, and they had this sort of long-standing agreement that when he died, that he instructed Helen Gandy to destroy or oversee the destruction of all of Hoover's secret files. So in other words, it wasn't a case that she was involved in destroying regular FBI records. All those files were preserved, and as I said, now millions of them are on the FBI's Vault website. But it was Hoover's private files that she oversaw the destruction of. And when Hoover died in 1972, President Nixon at the time quickly ordered his staff to get in there and try and grab all of Hoover's files. But what actually happened was that Helen Gandy had sort of anticipated this happening and moved in even quicker than Nixon's people, and managed to get all this material out of the FBI building. And again, it was all destroyed so that nobody could ever really find out what it contained. And that's still sort of the case today. There's a lot of speculation as to what Hoover's private files contained and who he was watching and why. But we'll probably never really know because, as I said, this was long before, you know, everybody was using scanners or sophisticated photocopiers. So it was the original material that was destroyed. So that's, you know, so another part of history that's gone. And but Helen Gandy, as I said, was, you know, she was sort of fiercely loyal to him all throughout her life and after his death as well, and even to the point where when she was questioned about the files, you know, when there was actually inquiry, she basically stood her ground and said, well, the files were destroyed, and she would not talk about the contents or anything like that at all.
Mm-hmm. She was an amazing woman, and she passed away when?
Oh, not too long ago, just a few years ago, but she was elderly when she died, and but she, as I said, she stood by him and his legacy, you know, right up to her dying day. She never sort of, you know, sold her story or anything like that. She just told the official line and as to what was known and left it at that.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that he had actually her office was the holding space for a lot of these documents. And
yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
That people did not have any idea. They thought it was going to be in Hoover's office. They were not aware also that there were other rooms that were filled with these dossiers that he had kept, and that she had actually started shredding this information a year before Hoover even died. There was a process already going on.
Yeah, that's right. They basically agreed to start getting rid of some of the sort of less confidential files bit by bit. But as you rightly point out, when the Nixon administration tried to grab the files, they assumed they were in Hoover's main office or some sub-offices he had, not realizing they were all in Helen Gandy's room, and that made it easier for her to get them out of the building and have them destroyed.
Mm-hmm. And you also bring out information about during Nixon's administration, when Louis Patrick Gray III, who was in position of acting director of the FBI until April 1973, he himself had illegally shredded documents to protect Nixon's administration during the Watergate scandal. Transparency, don't you just love that word? Transparency is supposed to mean something, and so many people toss it around like it is a piece of chocolate. Oh, yum, yum, this is great. But it's not really done. And your story is in here about how many documents have disappeared, everything from Marilyn Monroe's diary that was quite a thick diary people had seen disappear out of the coroner's office, and all of this is documented. And there's things that go on with so many different situations. And, of course, recently we have the JFK situation that people are really concerned about. They'd love to have the answers, but files have disappeared. They've been shredded, or they're somewhere in a gigantic vault environment sort of like the end of Indiana Jones's one movie. If you don't want to find something, put it in a government archive. Nobody will ever find it. And that to me is quite a situation, because the public, I don't care what part of the world we're in, the public just has no access to it. In the 90s, the same thing happened in Russia. The archives were made accessible to the public, and all of a sudden they were sealed. They had been opened, and the Russian people were astonished at what they found out about what had gone on, and there was such a furor that all of a sudden they were sealed again. No, you're not going to find out anymore. People couldn't gain access to them.
I think this often happens, you know, where files get shredded or they go missing or whatever. And I think, as I point out in the book, you know, I don't sort of point the finger at, the regular government. I actually think there's like almost like a shadow type agency that oversees all this, because often you find that when you file these Freedom of Information requests, even the people who are handling the request at the other end, they can't find the files. You know, they're not lying when they say they're not able to find them. You know, it's like I point out in the chapter in the book on Roswell as to how all the files have gone, but that there's this huge gap in the sort of 1947 files from the Roswell Army Air Force Base, which cannot be found. But the reason we know that is because the Air Force told us. So that's why I don't think today's Air Force is hiding anything at all, because they're as mystified as we are. But it's like somebody is sitting on the information. That's why I think it's more almost like an unofficial shadow group, not sort of, you know, one of the official agencies that's doing it. And that makes it much easier to hide the information.
There is so much fascinating material in your book. And again, you have all of this background information, and as you say, it is out there publicly. And there are always those individuals that say, I don't want the truth known, and they have the attitude that most individuals are too dumb to figure it out, which they're wrong about, but they also consider that there might be a public panic. I don't know why the truth is always considered to be a bad thing by a certain circle of people. Maybe for good reason, because they're afraid, just like Hoover was in many instances, that if what was found out, that it would have destroyed his world, which it would have at the time if that had come out. But there is so much here. There is so much documentation on history that is in your book. My goodness, do you ever get tired of doing this research?
Not really. I mean, you know, as I said, I do things sort of the proper way, the legal way, you know, using the Freedom of Information Act. And even though people say, oh, well, you don't get to see much, you actually do. You know, there's fascinating stories that have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. And so, you know, I enjoy researching it, because every day, you know, something surfaces. Even though if we don't get all the files or all the full story, we get part of it, and even the parts we do get, you know, they make for intriguing chapters in a book or sometimes an entire book.
Well, Nick Redfern, you have written a captivating piece of material here for Nobody's Eyes Only. What is your website that people can go to?
People can reach me at nickredfern40n, which is F-O-R-T-E-A-N, .blogspot.com, or they can type me into Facebook and find me there.
All right, Nick Redfern, 14, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, .blogspot.com. Nick, thanks ever so much for being with me today. It's been fascinating, and I look forward to your next publication. You have a wonderful, wonderful day, and thanks for keeping up the research.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Donna.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. Nick Redfern has been my guest for Nobody's Eyes Only. Check out Nick Redfern, 14, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, .blogspot.com. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. If you'd like to give me a buzz, telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008. Well, we have got a great lineup of people coming up. We're going to be discussing The Old Magic of Christmas by Linda Reiddick. We're also going to be talking with a practical Drucker. Yes, Drucker was a very famous businessman, also somewhat of a prophet when it came to dealing with financial issues in the world. William Cohen will be talking to. Put that cell phone down and look me in the eye. Brian Haggerty is going to be addressing the issues, not only of etiquette with the phone, but also good communication, how it makes a difference in everyday life. Susan Szymanski, the power of auras. And then we're going to be talking with Ken Potty. This is with a book about a real person. His code name is Sonny. And there were two books written about Ken. Mountains of Fire, and again, codenamed Sunny. So we've got just an absolutely dynamic lineup of guests coming up. I invite you to join me and share the information with your friends. There's a lot of changes that are coming around and a lot of fascinating people that are going to be on the Donna Cebu Show. And I invite you to find out about who they are, check out our show information site, and you will be able to determine who's coming up. And a little bit, not much, just a little bit, about what's going on with them. I hope you've had an absolutely awesome holiday. And I just thought, oh my goodness, how in the world can you take leftovers from a feast that perhaps you have prepared? And it's so easy to do certain things with food, especially after a holiday. And one of the things that I find is really great, and this is just the Donna tip. If you have a lot of sweet potato that you have left over, maybe you fixed a special dish up with that, just sort of put that in a blender with a few eggs and a couple of cups of milk. You need about, you can do this with pumpkin if you like it too, and maybe add a little bit of extra sugar and make it into a custard. Oh, it is so good. And then there's all kinds of things that you can do with leftover meat and vegetables. And you just need to know that all of that can sort of be recycled into some delicious meals that are going to really give you a relief, at least for a day or two, depending on how much you've got in the way of leftovers. If you're like me, when you have company, a lot of people go home with doggy bags. I'll call them Scotty bags, because it's something many times I find my sweet tooth craves goodies that I fix. And this is a good time always to fix, you know, have your holiday favorites. But if you don't want it around the house, give it away. It's a good thing. Quickly, I just want to cover some information about cougars. And the reason I wanted to talk about cougars is that we had a personal experience here in the Pacific Northwest with the cougar in our next-door neighbor's yard. Now, this was a couple of years ago, and it was during the summer, and it was absolutely one of these picture-perfect nights in the Pacific Northwest. And my two Scotties, who were just going ballistic, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and they were just causing so commotion. Of course, always concerned about my neighbors. There's hardworking people around us, and they might be in bed, and who needs a couple of Scottish terriers barking their little ears off? It's going to keep them awake. So I go outside. Now, our neighbor next door has a good-sized piece of land, and it was just a few days before I saw the sighting of the cougar that the grasses, and they get pretty high here, they can be like 4 feet tall. Well, they had been growing like crazy, and what occurred is they had gone in and cut all these grasses down, because during the summer that can be a fire hazard. So they had cut all the grasses down, so everything had been freshly cleared, and here is this beautiful cougar that is standing directly underneath a street light. And everything was quiet, and I was just stunned. This was a young cougar. I estimated it was about 2 years old. Beautiful creature. Now, once I went outside, my Scotty stopped barking their little ears off, but they were still vigilant. They were watching, because this was a critter that didn't belong in the neighborhood. Well, I watched too, and then the cougar stretched and laid down on the clear property, and was just absolutely gorgeous. There was nobody moving around. There wasn't any noise. Like I said, it was just a perfect night. Well, I had called our police department, and I ended up getting voicemail. Yes, don't you just love it when you call your local police department and you get voicemail? But I didn't call 911. I just left a message that there was a cougar that we had sighted. And the only thing that concerned me is that because of this cat, and it was a big cat, that if someone had decided all of a sudden, because it was such a warm night, to go out walking, that there could be a challenge, could be a problem. As it turned out, that didn't happen. But I called my husband, and he came out. He didn't believe me. And he said, "Wow, that's a big cat." I said, "Yes, it is." So as it turned out, the cat ends up getting up just very leisurely. He was a gift to us, and he ended up walking away by the time I finished making the phone call to the local police department. Well, the next morning, I get a call from Animal Wildlife. And what they said to me was there anything that you noticed about it? I said, no, the animal was just gloriously beautiful and was just, quote, quite relaxed. And the woman that was talking to me said, you know what? You were given a gift, because cougars don't show themselves to people. She then educated me and told me that cougars have about 100-mile territory, and their primary food is deer. Well, we have herds of deer around here. We've got all kinds of them. And she said that is one of the predators, but they have a 100-mile range. And I thought maybe it was a lack of water. She said, no, there's plenty of water in the area there. It's hunting game. It's out and about. She said, oh, probably you'll never see that cougar again. And as it's turned out, I doubt if we ever will. We see a lot of coyotes around here, but not cougars. Well, there's more and more information coming out about cougars and how they have adapted to the world of human population in surprising ways. Now, they avoid people as much as possible, but they are actually growing in population. They have learned, just like the wily e. coyote, how to live in an environment where they're feared and hated. But believe it or not, they're a very important part of nature, especially when it comes to keeping deer populations under control. Donna Sebo, my goodness, the hour has just flown by. I'm so delighted that you have chosen to spend time with me. Thank you so much for joining me at the Donna Sebo Broadcasting Table. I invite you to join me again. We've got a great lineup of people, and I think you'll find there's many things you don't know anything about, just like I didn't, until you hear about it on the Donna Sebo Show. This is Donna. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are on this phenomenal planet of ours. God bless. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.